Are we all prone to the malady of the introvert who turns away and gazes only upon the emptiness within? Perhaps the following conversation about introverts will clear up this Bertrand Russell idea. And perhaps you, dear listener, can weigh in.
The Matt Segundo Show is giving away two copies of Susan Cain's Quiet. All you have to do is email me at ed@edrants.com, edrants.com, with the subject line Quiet Giveaway before February 7th, 2012. Tell us when you first knew you were an introvert or an extrovert and what effect this has had on your life. Now, don't worry, if you're feeling shy, you can stay anonymous and we'll keep your name confidential. We'll read some of these stories on a future program and give away two copies of Quiet to two random people. In the meantime, to delineate this subject further, here's our conversation with Susan Cain. Enjoy. Okay, so I'm here with Susan Cain, who is most recently the author of Quiet. Susan, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Fantastic. A pleasure to have you. I should point out that as an ambivert, I am one of those types who swings both ways. I go ahead and ingratiate myself with all forms of aversion. I'm wondering if it's entirely productive to divide the world into these two austere bipolar categories. As you point out in the book, David Sloan Wilson applied these labels to the fruit fly. And
yes.
I'm wondering if, say, a Kinsey scale of 1 to 6, to pound the metaphor in here further,
right,
is probably more applicable for this kind of thing. I mean, why should introverts of all stripes be lumped together?
Yeah, okay, so that's actually a really important question that you're raising. And the reality is that we are all, that there's an introvert-extrovert spectrum, and that we're all situated on different points of the spectrum, and that even people who are on the extreme end of either end of the spectrum, whether introverts or extroverts, have sides to themselves that are the opposite side. And Jung, Carl Jung, who is the psychologist who actually popularized these terms,
yes,
speaks about that. And he says there's no such thing as a pure introvert or a pure extrovert, and that such a man would be in an insane asylum. So it's an important question that you're asking. But at the same time that this is true, and that we're all a glorious mishmash of traits, there is also a reality to what it means to be, you know, in general, oriented towards the outer world,
yeah,
or in general, are you more oriented towards the riches that are inside your own mind? And these things, I believe, these orientations shape who we are in ways that are as profound as the way our gender shapes us.
But gradients of orientation, I mean, that's the key thing. I mean, Jung, of course, as you point out, he popularized the terms in 1921. You have Hans Eysenck doing research in the late 1960s, hypothesizing that humans sought just right levels of stimulation.
Right.
And he ran
right.
some tests. So, I mean,
right,
you know, where do we, I suppose, calibrate ourselves if we're going to all refer to people as, oh, you're only an introvert, you're only an extrovert. I mean, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what
vertist,
I'd say.
So to speak.
Right. I guess I would say I would take the only out of that
yeah.
formulation. It's not you're only an introvert
yeah.
or only an extrovert. You're a million other things as well.
Yes.
But I guess, you know, a metaphor that I could give for you that I think is helpful here is gender.
Yeah.
So if I had written a book that presumed to say, you know, here is what men are like and here's what women are like, you know, I probably would have been able to get it mostly right describing these categories as groups. But in the case of any one individual, there are going to be, you know, there are men with all kinds of female characteristics and women with all kinds of male characteristics. That doesn't mean, though, that there's no such thing as maleness or femaleness, and that doesn't mean that these things aren't hugely important and shape our lives in ways we need to pay attention to.
Yes, but such a book would spawn a million Jezebel threads. mean, you know,
yeah,
there's a danger, I suppose, in cleaving to these labels, and I guess maybe another way of trying to figure out what's going on here in terms of the great schism between the introverts
yeah,
and the extroverts,
yeah,
there was a wonderful 2003 Jonathan Rauch article in The Atlantic, not
yes,
quoted in
yes,
here.
Yes, fantastic
yes,
article.
Yes, caring for
yeah.
your inner introvert. He was willing to go on the line and say that, no, you know, introverts are oppressed. I'm wondering if you would go on the line as well. You didn't in this book, but I mean, to what degree are they oppressed? I mean, since 2003, we've seen, for example, Google and Apple, products of introverts,
right,
spring up
right.
and we're all enslaved by them. So I think the balance may actually be
more or less stabilized. What do you think about this?
Okay, so first of all, I would say I actually did go on the line in this book, and you know, the central thesis of my book really is that there is a severe bias against introversion in this society, and that that operates to all of our losses. You know, certainly to the loss of introverts who feel, who get the message in a million different ways that there's something wrong with who they are. But I think it operates to the loss of everybody, because when we set up society in a way that depletes the energies of half, a third to a half of the population, that's not in anybody's interest.
Yeah.
That's my feeling about it.
But no real oppression. I mean, if the extroverts are in control, then, you know, I guess, I don't know. Do you think that there's been enough, I suppose, of a comeback for the introverts in the years since that Roch article?
Well, okay. So I think it's an interesting thing. So when I talk about a bias, you know, I'm not saying, therefore, introverts have had no happiness and no success in society. And the, you know, the examples that you just gave are very interesting and apt ones. But here's the thing. Those examples, they're not accidents. You know, we tend to have respect for the loner who is operating in his garage and is about to launch a fabulously successful company, or who holds the promise of launching such a company. We have respect for that person because that person carries with him, you know, the whiff of great wealth or great power. But what I'm talking about is something that operates at a kind of deeper level of self. And the fact is that if you look at our schools and our workplaces, you know, the institutions where we all spend our lives and where our daily happiness is shaped, those institutions are set up for extroverts in ways that we're not aware of. You know, so children, from the time they go into preschool at a very young age, they are going into an environment that is a group environment where they're expected to behave in certain ways. And this is not, I'm not saying this is all a bad thing, but I am saying there, it's set up in such a way that introverted children from the get-go are kind of expected to act in ways that are not themselves.
Yes. But it's interesting to me that the loner has moved from, say, the sort of James Dean, Rebel Without a Cause, Marlon Brando kind of thing to the guy going ahead like Wozniak and fiddling around with tools in his garage, in his bedroom, starting a company. And I'm wondering if the loner model has always been associated with introverts, or whether there has been some sort of, I guess, outsider label instead. It seems to me that because the idea of being the loner was predicated in some way to being a loner in relation to society.
Right,
you weren't
right.
entirely an introvert. You were more of an outsider. You were still an extrovert in some sense.
Right,
and yet it has moved in the decades since to the sort of Wozniakian model, where you're tinkering with some massive project that's going to change the world in your garage. I wonder if you had some thoughts on why loner has almost been co-opted and has become more related to this introversion idea.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. You know, I think that that's probably just a function of the role that technology has played in the last decades. You know, what you're talking about really is ways in which we have shifted notions of glamour as attached to individual people.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the 50s, the decades of conformity, there was a glamour attached to the figure who could stand outside that and still have sex appeal.
Yes.
And then what happens, you know, in the decades of technology is suddenly we have introverts who, just because of their great technical competence, can create wealth and power, and so glamour attaches to them.
Introverts aren't sexy? I think they are. I think they're being celebrated in our culture. The whole Think Different billboards that we got with Apple. I mean, it's been all about, yes, introverts are sexy, but we just don't communicate with other people. So you think they aren't sexy?
No, what I was saying was that they're... What was happening as technology grew up is that there was a glamour that was attached to that.
Yes.
You know, but what I still believe is that is... That's a kind of subset of the reality of what it means to be introverted.
Yeah.
And, you know, even if you go out to Silicon Valley, you know, the heart of this subset where you would say that this glamour model, for lack of a better word, is operating. You know, even in Silicon Valley, I went out there while I was researching my book, and I talked to many introverts who are working there. And even there, they feel that their personality style is not validated and is not celebrated. Yeah. And they're constantly exhorted to act in a way that's not natural to themselves.
I suppose this relates to the initial line of inquiry. When you were talking about introverts, when you were promoting introverts, they inevitably, I suppose, feed into this marketing advertorial sort of approach, where it's not so much about trying to understand the introvert's place, it's more about promoting the introvert. I mean, this leads me to also think of a figure who you didn't mention in the book, Edward Bernays. I mean, we were talking about Jung earlier, but he relied upon Freudian ideas to promote the idea of being empowered and that manipulation could be used to factor in the herd crowd, and herd is a word that crops up frequently in your book. Do you think that one of the problems with introverts being misunderstood or not accepted has a lot to do with this, I suppose, maligning or skirmishing of psychology with these larger marketing forces? Or to what degree?
Well, you know, I think that it actually goes back even earlier than that. You know, I think that where it really comes from, well, it starts out with there just being this kernel in our society. We are a culture that is founded on Greco-Roman ideals.
Yes.
And these are ideals that celebrate oratory and celebrate, you know, being able to declaim in front of people. So that's a piece of it. But that's only a small piece, really, because what really happened is that at the turn of the 20th century, we moved from what cultural historians call a culture of character, and we moved into a culture of personality.
Yeah.
And this happened because suddenly we had the rise of big business and we had urbanization. So you had people flocking into the cities. And instead of living in small towns and working with people they had known all their lives, they're suddenly in big cities vying for jobs at corporations where everything depends on their ability to shine at a job interview and to be able to sell their company's latest gizmo, and of course to sell themselves, you know. And at the same time, then you have the rise of movies and movie stars, and movie stars of course are the perfect model for this,
of course,
you know, like they are the ultimate role models of this kind of charisma that people now are starting to feel they need in their everyday lives. And so, you know, where it used to be, like in the earlier years of this country's founding, where it used to be that these oratorical skills and this ability to command a crowd was seen as being important only for political figures, now it was something that everybody suddenly had to have.
Yeah.
And at the core of all this was the corporation, really. You know, that was why people started to feel they needed to have these skills.
But it's interesting that your book tends to go to Tony Robbins seminars or corporate layouts with which to determine where the introvert stands. I mean, why go to business almost before anything else in the course of grappling with this very complicated question?
Well, I wouldn't say that the book only goes to business. I think it goes, it ranges pretty far and wide.
Yeah.
But I do focus a lot on business. You're right about that. And I do that deliberately because I think that business forces in this way shape so much of what we believe to be the ideal self.
Yeah.
You know, they shape it in our day-to-day lives. We show up at work and we're expected to act a certain way. I went to a Tony Robbins seminar, you know, to report on what is really being sold there.
Yeah.
Because the self-help industry is, you know, I don't have the exact figures at my fingertips, but it's a multi-billion-dollar industry,
yes,
you know, into which Americans pour their money and their hopes. And it's a business that promises to reveal to us what is the ideal self and how can we help you become the ideal self. So if you go to a Tony Robbins seminar and you see that the ideal self that is being marketed to you is one that is very explicitly extroverted, that's very revealing.
Let's go to a guy I love but I have great difficulty pronouncing his name, of course, Csikszentmihalyi.
Yes.
It's something along those lines. But his idea of flow,
you
bring it up in the book. Flow, of course, is that optimal state of activity where you're just totally absorbed in what you're doing.
Yeah.
Introverts in a state of flow may find their energy is boundless, as you suggest in the book. But
yes.
When I went and flipped to your end note, you point to a Peter Hills and Michael Argyle 2001 study where introverts and extroverts are happy for pretty much the same reasons, fulfillment at work, self-esteem, etc. How does flow and happiness differ between introverts and extroverts, just out of clarification here.
Yeah. So flow is just a hugely important concept. It's a transformative concept once you really understand it, because we should all try to live in a state of flow as much as we can. So what's key here is that introverts and extroverts might reach a state of flow in quite different ways. You know, so for an introvert I'll speak for myself as an introvert. I am in a state of flow when I write. You know, I love to be like alone with my, I love to sit at a cafe with my laptop and be alone with my thoughts in the presence of others. That's total flow for me. an extrovert might really need a lot more social interaction to get into a state of flow. But they're both reaching that transcendent state just through very different means.
Yeah. But it's interesting that your happiness when you're at the cafe is figured in some relation to other people. And so that's rather curious.
Yeah. You know? I don't think it's curious at all because I'm at no point here equating introversion with being antisocial or with being a hermit. You know, I'm more saying that it's a different way of being social.
Well, this seems as good a time as I need to bring up where one finds the fine line between introversion and misanthropy. I mean, you point to 37 Signals as Jason Fried's idea, No Talk Thursday, where you have one day out of the week in which employees are not allowed to talk with each other at all. And I was thinking to myself, well, you know, this is a little on the extreme end. I mean, you know, you have the classroom sign that you bring up that reads, you can't ask a teacher for help unless everyone in your group has the same questions.
Yeah.
Introverts, no. They're not asocial beings. They don't hate people, as you point out so many times in the book. I mean, even Wozniak needed that stimulus of the homebrew computer club. And
wouldn't even say even Wozniak. Wozniak is an incredibly kind man. He was going and giving stock options out to people who hadn't been awarded them by Steve Jobs because he's such a caring guy.
But it seems to me that by pointing to Jason Fried's idea, I saw very clearly that everything that goes, yes, you must be extrovert, can also go the other way with introversion. You know, how do you balance this idea of living in your head with reaching out to other people? I mean, that's important,
okay.
too.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, I think that the way to understand something like a No Talk Thursdays is it's a semi-tongue-in-cheek response to the extreme lopsidedness of the extroversion of our workplaces. You know, nobody would be calling for a no-talk Thursday if they weren't subject to an all-talk all-the-time Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's really just a kind of playful counter-reaction to that.
Yeah,
and,
but playful counter-reactions can sometimes be taken to a reductio ad absurdum level. To cite one example, I found weeks ago, I just was going online, and I saw that someone had set up a workshop, How to Talk to Strangers, which I found to be just sort of way over the line in terms of, I mean, sometimes you just have to kind of figure out your own way to do it, whether you're an introvert or an extrovert.
Yeah, sure.
And so something like No Talk Thursday, which may initially start off as a sort of ridiculous, sort of adhered idea, sometimes gets taken seriously by other people. And so I think that having a good conversation about introverts is vital.
Yeah.
But you also have to understand that, like, what most people would realize is that, hey, I'm really busy. Can I talk to you in, like, tomorrow? You know, instead of, like, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think that most people understand the spirit in which people are talking about these things.
Yeah. But you're oppressing in reverse here with No Talk Thursday. Do you endorse No Talk Thursday? Or, I mean, you know, what of this situation? Do you think that introversion may, in fact, reach this, it could go the other way? And introversion may be just as much of a, I suppose, autocratic force as extroversion is.
You know, if that really happened, then that would be an oppressive thing. I don't think that's going to happen. And I don't think that's what anybody is advocating. Certainly not what I'm calling for. And it's not what I've heard anybody else call for. Huh. You know, I think that what we really need is a kind of restoration of balance, you know, just a kind of sanity where there's room for solitude and there's room for people to be interacting.
Well, let's look at this from another standpoint. You bring up the infamous Solomon Asch experiments in which actors offering incorrect answers were planted in groups.
Yeah.
And this, of course, resulted in the correct answers falling to 25%. Now, this is a wonderful example of how conformity can create wrong results and can also, when you think about it, create devastating results. But I'm wondering how conformity relates to introversion. Extroverts are just as likely to be persuaded by a very charming figure who can beguile the pants off of anyone.
Oh,
so,
sure.
You know,
the reason that I talked about the Asch experiments, it wasn't so much about introversion, extroversion per se. It was more to point out the dangers of relying too much on a group for making decisions or for trying to come to a creative result. So it was just one example I was giving of ways that groups can really be led seriously awry. Yeah. Because, you know, what happens when we come into groups, we are such innately social creatures, all of us, introverts included. We're all so social that that we instinctively start to mimic, you know, the opinions of other people without even realizing we're doing it. And so the more updated version of the Solomon Asch experiment that I talk about in the book, you know, they were actually able to figure out kind of what was going on in the minds of people when they are conforming in this way. And often they don't realize that they're conforming.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that they're saying, I want my boss to like me, so I'm going to pretend to go along with this ridiculous thing. Instead, they actually truly believe the ridiculous thing, and they believe that they came to it on their own.
A subconscious desire to fit in, basically.
Yeah, or, you know, fit in is even it's a subconscious desire. Yeah, I guess you could say fit in, although that's
to be understood by.
It's a subconscious. Yeah, it's a subconscious desire to be as one with a group. That's what I would say. But then it is interesting to use the fit in language. What they've also found now. What neuroscientists have found, a neuroscientist named Gregory Burns from Emory University did this interesting study where he was able to determine what is going on in the brains of people when they are dissenting from a group.
Yeah.
And what he found is that there's a small organ in the brain called the amygdala, which is associated with a fear of social rejection. And he found that the amygdala becomes very activated when you are dissenting from the group. And that's because it can be a painful thing to take a stand different from those around you. And he actually calls this, Gregory Burns does, he calls this the pain of independence.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what I'm trying to do is point out we should not be relying on groups as much as we do.
Yeah.
We should be honoring more the individual mind.
You get into high reactive types being more likely to be introverts. What is the degree of pain that introverts feel along these lines? Are they more likely to have their amygdala set off like some flashing light in the dark? I mean, you know, what of this?
Yeah, so this is an interesting thing. You know, it turns out that that there is a subgroup of babies who are born with high reactive nervous systems, as you're saying. And what this means is that their nervous systems, and specifically their amygdala that I was just talking about, is kind of more reactive to any kind of incoming stimuli, and especially new stimuli, and especially, let's say, a new face, you know, a new person who you're meeting. And they've actually traced this, and they've found that this continues, you know, all the way through the lifespan. And so, or at least they've measured it now, although a man named Jerome Kagan and his protege, Carol Schwartz, have measured this all the way up to the age of 20. And so what this means is that you can take a child who's quite shy, and they may grow up to be a person who doesn't really appear shy at all, and who's quite, you know, socially fluid. But when they go into a social setting, when they see a new face, their amygdala is going to be more reactive than someone without this nervous system. And so, I think that explains for many people why it is that they might more or less overcome their shyness, but they still feel that it's kind of a part of them in some, you know, important and deep level.
Yeah. Going back to an issue I sort of got to earlier, we were talking about, you know, whether it's an introvert or extrovert society. And near the end of the book, you bring up the Asian American population in Cupertino and how they're very much driven by a sense of quietude and a sense of silence to achieve great academic worth and the like. And I'm curious about this because there is mentioned talking is not always a positive act, but it's not always a negative act too. What of, I suppose, a pluralistic movement to yield positive results for introverts and extroverts? I mean, it seems to me that the Cupertino system is almost, I suppose, opposed or is in some way positioned in opposition to the present one that's throughout the remainder of the world. So what of this?
Yeah, well, I actually wouldn't say that the Cupertino system is opposed to, you know, a more Western view of the world, let's say, because, you know, actually the students who I met, and I talked about this in the chapter, the students who I met and their parents were quite interested in learning ways of acting, you know, more extroverted. And in fact, one of the high schools that I visited there has one of the largest speech and debate programs. I think it was in their state or in their county. And this is because they are interested in seeking this kind of balance.
Yeah. Well, Jerome Kagan, who you talked to in this book, offered evidence that high reactivity, which we were talking about before, was a biological basis for introversion. But yet even you are forced to write, maybe the mystery of what percent of personality is nature and what percent nurture is less important than the question of how your inborn temperament interacts with the environment and with your own free will.
Yeah, so sure.
Is there any surefire way to corral the nature versus nurture question here?
No. You know, Jerome Kagan also talks about how does he put it? You know, trying to really tease out nature from nurture is like trying to decide how much of a blizzard is caused by temperature versus humidity. You know, they are the nature versus nature debate. Nature versus nurture debate is giving way to a view called interactionism, where I think people really acknowledge that it is and always will be an interaction between the two forces.
Yeah. Well, I mean, how does one make sense of it? I mean, should we just look at both? I mean, is there any real way to untangle it at all? I mean, it seems this is a vital thing to do if one is examining the notion of being an introvert or an extrovert.
Yeah. You know, I don't think that you can untangle it to a precise degree of certitude. I don't think we need to really. You know, I think it's enough to understand that both of these things matter, and that therefore we need to pay attention to them both.
This is going to be a very elaborate question, but I was really fascinated by it. Yeah. You write in the book that Alex Osborne's brainstorming session is predicated on four basic rules, which I'll cite. One, don't judge or criticize ideas. Two, be freewheeling. The wilder the idea, the better. Three, go for quantity. The more ideas you have, the better. Four, build on the ideas of fellow group members. Anyway, you say that brainstorming doesn't actually work.
Right.
You point to this Marvin Dunette study in 1963, which showed that men producing more ideas, they produced more ideas when they worked on their own time. You also quote the organizational psychologist Adrian Fernham, who wrote that business people must be insane to use brainstorming groups. And you also write that online brainstorming is an exception. Mm-hmm. Now, this had me absolutely fascinated, and I ended up, kind of going on a crazy Google quest, and I noted that Stanford professor Robert Sutton has suggested that the academic studies don't really take into account this tendency for workers to switch from individual and group productivity in an instant. I mean, I'm wondering to what degree these workplace demands are more of an offshoot of multitasking. I mean, there's that French study a couple years ago where they said that the brain kind of craters at a certain point when you get into multitasking.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if that's more the problem than the idea of brainstorming. Are there any real-world possibilities for brainstorming? I mean, is it just a sullied model that people are working off of the Osborne thing?
Well, you know, one I think undisputed benefit of brainstorming is that while it may not produce the best ideas, it does produce group cohesion, and it does produce a sense of trust and morale. And so what you actually find is if you ask people who have just participated in a brainstorming session, you know, how'd you do? They will say that they did great, and they'll really mean it. And that's because they're responding to the social cues that have formed.
Yeah.
So there's a value to it, you know, even in and of itself.
But there's no value in terms of a conceptual way? I mean, there may be a lot of bad ideas, but maybe there might be a good idea. I mean, it seems if you have very smart people put in a room, and maybe they're not socially connected, or maybe this might not be the best venue for their ideas.
Right,
Certainly, a smart person who also is understood, the more you meet with them, might actually come up with something.
Yeah, and sure. What I would really recommend is a kind of hybrid model. I think that people should be encouraged to go off by themselves to try to solve problems, see what they come up with, for real, and then they can get together to talk about what they've come up with.
We're both advocating pluralism here. That's good. Near the end of the book.
Yeah, I should say, throughout, it's important to me to call for balance. It's not like I'm trying to reverse what's to replace the lopsidedness that we have had up to date with a new lopsidedness.
Yeah.
I want to replace it with balance.
Absolutely. I mean, and what I'm trying to do is just trying to ferret out some of the points in this book so that people can understand that it's not necessarily an extreme thing one way or the other.
Yeah, which is important. Yeah. You're right.
Near the end of the book, you suggest that parents of introverted children need to seek out schools which accommodate shy students. Under the demands, though, of the No Child Left Behind Act, which calls for 100% mandatory commitment to standards, including kids with disabilities, it's a rather insane idea that's going to be in effect in 2014, and it's going to, in fact, create sanctions for teachers and principals who can't meet the job. I mean, based off of that, that may not necessarily be compatible with this idea of parents finding schools, unless, of course, they have wealth to find a private school to do this. So what of the parent who doesn't have the financial resources to find that ideal school, the parent who has an introverted child? I mean, how can you get their kids to cope if they only have public schools, they have the No Child Left Behind problem, et cetera? I mean, what of this? Mm-hmm. Do you have any solutions?
Well, I mean, the best thing that you can do is public schools are filled with good teachers also,
yes.
Right? So you can try to talk with a teacher, your child's teacher, and make sure that they understand what your child's temperament is. And,
yeah.
You know, you can try to kind of suss out whether that teacher gets it or not. A lot of teachers do get temperament. Some do, some do not.
But if you're dealing with an overworked teacher who has to meet the No Child Left Behind standards and
right.
doesn't necessarily have the time in their schedule to give to your child, I mean, you know, are there any other coping mechanisms aside from, you know, trying to survive or what?
Well, you know, one thing is arming your child
yeah.
with the strength that they need. And so, you know, one of those things is instilling in them a real sense of pride in who they are, you know, and helping them understand, like, so look, this is your way of being. It takes you longer to feel comfortable. It takes you a while to feel comfortable in a new situation.
Yeah.
That's okay. That's cool. That's fine. And you'll get there. So just know that it's worth sort of punching through your discomfort until you get to the good place on the other side. You know, and as your child gets older, there are ways to sort of work with them and practice with them, like do, what's the word I'm looking for? Not role modeling, but role playing.
Yeah.
You know, role play with them situations that the child finds difficult.
Yes.
Like, you know, how do you break into a new group? Well, maybe you find the one approachable looking child who's on the outskirts of the group and you connect with them and that eases your way in.
Yeah.
You know, or you teach your child to smile when they feel afraid because, of course, smiling makes all of us feel calmer and happier, and it also signals to other people that you're available to be chatted with.
Yeah.
You know, so there are things that you can do to help your shyer child.
Sure. Now, it's worth pointing out that public speaking remains, according to many studies, the worst fear in
right.
America, more so than fear of death, more so
yes.
than fear of disease. You write that because public speaking is an inherently stimulating activity, introverts can find their attention impaired just when they need it most. You quote Brian Little in an endnote, you say extroverts often find that they are able to handle cramming for speeches or briefings in a way that would be disastrous for introverts. But I should point out that many of our finest actors, Marlon Brando, who I mentioned mm-hmm. before, Johnny
yes,
Depp,
yes,
Meryl
this is
Streep,
so true.
Jack Lemmon, Laura Linney,
yeah.
they are all
yeah.
introverts.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
you know, what of the idea of the performance mask? I mean,
yes.
you know, they seem to be able to handle the stimulation of performing and speaking before a huge audience. Did you uncover any research to account for, I suppose, the theatrical instinct?
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, there is what the studies show is that introverts are disproportionately affected by stage fright, which is actually a little different from the stimulation point you were
yeah.
just talking about with Brian Little. But anyway, but there still is a subset of introverts who are perfectly comfortable with public speaking. And many performers, as you say, are introverts. You know, and I've interviewed a lot of these people, and I think that what is going on for them is It's as you say, there's a kind of mask that they're putting on, and it's not them, and it's a more, they kind of convert what could be an otherwise overstimulating situation into something that's very manageable, because it's
yeah.
something they prepare for, they're behind their mask, they're doing their role, it's just, you know, them delivering their thing to the audience, and it becomes something that is very easy to do in a masterful way.
Is
what,
it always
what Brian
a mask,
Little
though?
Was taught? No,
yeah.
not necessarily. You know, people have different styles. What Brian Little was talking about there is that it's harder for introverts to, in general, to just get up and do these things on the fly because it's such a stimulating situation. So that introverts generally need to prepare more for these kinds of roles than an
yeah.
extrovert would.
What about like improvisation and all that? I mean, there are introverted actors who are very good at improvising as
sure,
well. I mean,
sure.
you know, I'm wondering what allows them to perform that, say, other introverts cannot. Is
right,
it just being a
right.
more social introvert, do you think? Or?
You know, that's interesting. You know, first of all, these things are massively complex,
yes,
right?
Of course.
So,
which is why we're unpacking them.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But, you know, for some people, this becomes an art form, and so that's the art form that you study.
Yeah.
And, you know, with something like, let's say, the fear of public speaking, that's something that anybody can become desensitized to with time. It's like
yeah.
the more you do it, the more it becomes something easy to do and less frightening to do. So I have heard of many introverts actually seeking out things like improvisation because it's a way of desensitizing them to their fear.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and in fact, I'm a member because I have suffered with stage fright,
yeah.
Suffered from it. So I'm a member of Toastmasters, which
yeah.
is this group. It's a worldwide organization where people meet in small local groups, and you get together once a week or once every 2 weeks to practice public speaking. And I can report that many of the people who join Toastmasters are introverts.
Yeah.
And one of the features of Toastmasters is that at every single meeting, you get up and you do impromptu speaking, yeah. You know, the kind that you can't prepare for and you just have to speak on the fly. You know, and it's really hard at the beginning, but it does get easier and easier.
Yeah.
So.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I should point out, I've taken a number of improv classes for precisely this reason.
Yeah.
It's not so much stage fright. It's also just being concerned with other people's self-awareness. But I suppose that is also an introverted quality. But, you know, you take improv classes, you throw yourself into anarchy, and then all of a sudden you sort of take yourself less seriously and you become more comfortable for that.
So, I mean, anarchy comes to seem less anarchic.
Exactly.
Right?
And actually it's quite fun and all that.
Yeah.
Which doesn't necessarily take away. I still have plenty of introverted moments, but it's allowed my half extrovert, I suppose, to come out too.
Yeah, you know? Sure.
Speaking of which, introversion and creativity, I wanted to talk about Csikszentmihalyi, who I have to bring up again. You mentioned him performing a study of 91 exceptionally creative people in his really remarkable book, Creativity.
Yeah. Yeah.
He determined that his subjects were on the social margins because their intense curiosity or focused interest seems odd to their peers. Ooh, outsiders again. I'm wondering if curiosity or focused interest is really an introverted quality. I mean, even he revealed in A Life Worth Living that disinterest or the absence of creativity or absence of curiosity causes an individual to stagnate in work and school, results in relationship suffering. I mean, when it comes to creative people, ultimately, isn't it the work that matters more than the personality type? What of these issues?
Well, this is all very complex stuff. but what you see with introverted people is that they are comfortable with the solitude that is a crucial ingredient to creativity. And for extroverts can be very creative. They have to struggle more often with that piece of the creative puzzle.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not so much the curiosity itself. That's not really related to introversion or extroversion.
Yeah.
You know, it's more like the behavioral style. You know, so even somebody like a Picasso, who I think was probably a quite extroverted character in many ways, but he speaks about how no great work can be done without solitude. And so he was able to, you know, to seek out that solitude. He could do it. But I also can't pronounce his name well, but Csikszentmihalyi, you know, talks about how there are teenagers who are extroverts and have great talents, but sometimes they can't cultivate their talents because they're uncomfortable, you know, segregating themselves from the social fabric long enough to do it.
One of the charges that extroverts sometimes bring up in relation to introverts that, oh, well, you know, this is all a bunch of false modesty. This is all about egotism. This is all about confidence. How do we answer those charges that it's not about this sense of arrogance or hubris? I mean, it's almost sometimes I see some extroverts can't quite understand this quality, and it is, of course, rooted in the self, but at the same time, it doesn't necessarily translate into an automatic Napoleonic complex. So what of this? What's the answer here?
That's a good one. I have heard that charge from time to time, and you know, it's always funny from inside an introverted psyche to hear that charge because it just feels so disconnected to any sense of the reality that you're experiencing. I think the answer really is just to understand what introversion actually is. And when you understand it as just a simple preference for a less stimulating environment, and therefore you sometimes need to seclude yourself, or therefore you might prefer the company of just one friend to many because it's a less stimulating thing to do, you know, that kind of removes it from the whole construct of, is it ego, is it narcissism, is it this, is it that? It actually has nothing to do with those things.
Well, on that note, and with the hope that both of us can pronounce cheek me. Csikszentmihalyi. Susan, thanks very much. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
Oh, it was so much fun to chat with you. Thank you.